Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our May 23rd show of 2015. We are continuing our series on British Christian beat bands of the 60s. And tonight, our special guest is Doug Hollidge of The Venturers and the Brian Gilbert Group. Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's good to be on.
It's great to have you on. As I learned this amazing thing that was going on with British music, I know that British Christian music... And when I was talking to, and I have to plug John Plater's website, 1960sChristianMusic.com, for anyone listening to this that wants to know more about the Christian beat movement that was going on in England at that time, in the time of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Kinks and the different bands, there was also this movement of Christian music and the Joy Strings and the Pilgrims and the Peacemakers and these bands that were out there spreading the Christian message with music that was amazing. And the thing, Doug, that we've got a lot to talk about in an hour, but one of the things that I come across sometimes when I'm talking to people about music is that they'll sometimes think of Christian music as a certain way, and they'll have it in their mind that this is what it is, and there's nothing else. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is break down those barriers and to let people know about the great musicianship that the Christian bands had and still have to this day. And what we want to talk about are the bands that you were a part of in that time. Now, I believe the first band, Doug, that you were in was The Venturers. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's the other way around. It's with Brian Gilbert Group that started out, and The Venturers followed.
Okay. So what year did the Brian Gilbert Group form?
Now, if you are a believer in distinct moments in time when something very, very special happens, then we're into something about the start of the Brian Gilbert group. Because in 1952, way back in 1952, he came as a young 19-year-old music student studying at the Royal Academy of Music. He came to my home church for the real reason of playing in the church cricket team. He had a great friend who was my older cousin, and it was an involvement that was beginning to develop, and my cousin was going to be baptized. And so Brian came to the church for the very first time, and I sat alongside him in the gallery of my home church. And at the end of an amazing evening, when the baptism had taken place and the preaching of the word had taken place, Brian said to me, "Doug, I'm going out forward. Jesus has become real to me."
Well, that's
so
awesome.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, and that was 1952?
That was 1952. So he stayed on in the home church, at my home church, and developed all sorts of music within the church. He became the choir master of a youngsters' church choir. And because he'd become a Christian, he'd picked up with a musical friend of his, a South African guy, and each of them played the Spanish guitar very, very well. And they formed a little group, a duo together, and they began recording material for what was called then the Christian Radio and Television Commission.
Wow.
And a number of old 78s. Do you remember 78s?
Oh, yeah.
Well, a couple of 78s were brought out under the Christian Radio and Television Commission title. And this was before Brian had got what we call the call to full-time ministry. And that meant he then went to Spurgeon's College after a time of internship at a London church, where fortunately the minister of that church was an excellent singer. And Brian's singing and work with the young people continued, and it was the time when skiffle was all about, and the church grew its own little skiffle group, and Brian was a part of that. Now, you're titling these sessions about beat music. Well, it's an incredible start when you're talking about skiffle as the way in. But that's
exactly
what it was for Brian. He'd been down to a coastal town on the south coast, a very famous coastal town, Brighton, and he'd overlooked a very sort of a strange place. It was called the Fish Market, and there was a skiffle group playing, and he saw that crowds were following, and Brian thought to himself, skiffle might be a way in order to get some ground, provide a doormat so that we can preach the gospel. And that's how it started. And he then went to Spurgeon's College. And in college, the whole group, Brian Gilbert group, began. And it was a very strange group. There were two professional musicians, himself as a Spanish guitarist, a violin player, who was an excellent violin player. There was a guy who played a side drum in a boys brigade band. There was a guy who played in a piano accordion. And typical of the old skiffle groups, they devised a T-chest bass, and that was the Brian Gilbert group. That's the start of it, my friend. Way, way, way back when Brian entered Spurgeon's College in 1956.
Now, from that point on, what happened there? And you were talking about, you know, using the skiffle music as an avenue to reach people for Jesus, which, you know, I think is such an amazing thing because, you know, I've come across people, Doug, that are very, I don't know what word I can use here, but they think that, you know, when you change and do musical things differently, then it can bring in the devil's music. And I'm not sure what people thought of skiffle music at that time, but I know that when rock and roll music was introduced, there were people that, you know, embraced it and knew that it was, if it was, you know, presented the right way, had the right lyrics, was perfectly fine. But there were other people that were, you know, that I've known, and even in my experience, that, okay, that's no matter what, that music can't be used for Jesus or for Christianity because it's just not pure, it's just not, you know, the way that we think it should be. Now, did the Brian Gilbert group at that time in 1956, did they find any resistance to that?
Right from the start.
Okay.
Resistance right from the start, and from the faculty of the college. And it was very hard that the college were in an interim period between principals. I think you'd call them over in the States presidents. But the college was in between the change of principals, and the faculty were not too happy with the Skiffle group. But the point that was being made was that at certain outreach occasions that Brian was involved in, they went, and in succeeding years, every Easter, we all went to this place, wonderful industrial setting in Luton, sort of not too far away from London. And at Luton, there was a Methodist church, an industrial mission. And the guy who ran that had access to large premises, huge premises with theater, all sorts of things. And this guy had developed a Saturday night at Luton, they called it, when all sorts of new music was played. And Brian was invited. And he went to Luton in 1957 for the first time in November of that year and sort of set the place alight. And afterwards, he was contacted by the national press. And we heard over previous sessions with your good program about cartoons being drawn about the joy strings. Well, I have to tell you that cartoons were drawn about Brian's involvement, and it hit the national daily papers. In a Christmas edition of the daily paper called the Daily Mail, they showed a cartoon of a Skiffle group singing "Hark the Herald Angels Rock."
That's great.
The Christmas song, but it was a wonderful little takeoff of their group, guitar, T-chest bass, and this was in snow and whatever. So this was in a daily paper, and the press contacted him. And at the end of 1957, Brian was already setting up what he believed to be a summer outreach program on the south coast of England. And this got to be known by the local papers. And in the early part of 1958, in one of the strangest settings in the Daily Mirror paper, which has at times allegedly run all sorts of difficult stuff, sort of headline-grabbing stuff.
Right.
They not only put a picture of the Brian Gilbert group, but they had the headline, "Dig These Hep Cat Preachers." And this was in the middle pages of the Daily Mirror. And, of course, as soon as this hit the middle pages of the Daily Mirror, Brian was in real trouble at college. And he was ordered into the new principal's office, and the faculty were there saying, "What do you mean about this, blah, 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 what you're planning in the summer?" And he was in real trouble. And one of the things that the faculty said to him is, what instruments are you using? And they'd heard that he was using an old washboard. Do you remember those, the
oh,
old
yeah.
washboard?
Yes.
But Brian said, "No, you got that wrong. We don't use a washboard." But they were told, the Brian Gilbert was told, the group was told that they could go on this event in the South Coast, but they must not mention that they came from Spurgeon's College.
Oh, wow.
That's how anti the faculty were. But Brian went ahead, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Which is amazing because, you know, when I do these interviews, Doug, and I listen, and I talk to the different people, there are people that were afraid of change, and there were people that weren't. What do you think it was with Brian, and we're going to get into your involvement here, that was the catapult or the power behind, okay, I know this isn't something that's been done in the past. I know I'm getting resistance. I know there are people that are saying this is wrong. But what is it that you think from the Brian Gilbert group and then from the other groups, but we can speak specifically on this one, that said, okay, I'm not going to turn backwards. I'm going to continue to move forward with this music.
It's very straightforward, John, in that in the year that Brian went to college, they were celebrating the fact that it was 100 years since Charles Haddon Spurgeon had started the college. and they set in process a whole number throughout the country of special events, preaching the gospel, blah, blah, blah. And Brian was a part of this. He'd only newly got to college, but when he found that he was a part of that in this old-time setting, there were very few results. A great deal of effort had been put in, and Brian said to himself, this is not the way to do it. I've got my gifting. God has given me my gifting, and this is what we must do. And he wrote this. I've just got a quote here. The Venturers, he was using the collective name of the Venturers, the Venturers have one burning desire to preach Christ, but not, as has been the case, to half-empty churches where outsiders are a rarity, but to the man in the street. Where music has helped us to gain a hearing, we've used it. But where it has not been needed, we've not used it. It's as simple as that. So he was using his gifting of music to create a way in.
Well, that was quite revolutionary at that time, I think. Because using the music, and what we're going to get into how music was changing in that time, and then how, you know, the Christian beat, you know, music came in, and how that the Liverpool beat and the Mercy beat and all this came in. And it was a definite change in the way that music, that people heard music. And over here in the U.S., I mean, it was totally, it just kind of changed everything. The rock and roll bands and all the older bands and stuff, everything changed when that type of music started to come over. Now, for Brian to make that, I think it would be totally in faith where he would say, you know what, I'm going to follow what I believe is my you know, my calling. And that can be a scary thing because...
Indeed it is.
Well, it could be a very scary thing, especially if you're a part of the college and they're telling you, well, you can go out there, but don't say you're from here. Now, did that continue like that, Doug, or did it sooner or later did they come on board?
Well, the new principal who came in was very much more enlightened, and he was an evangelist at heart, and he saw in the way that the group was being used in all sorts of areas in London and the wider areas around London. He saw its effectiveness, and he gave it a real blessing. So it enabled Brian to develop it. And strangely, you mentioned the Liverpool sound. The very next year, in 1959, they had almost 3-week event up in Liverpool, actually at the People's Church in Everton. And before the Beatles got on the Mersey boat, the Venturers, Brian Gilbert Group, actually played to 900 passengers on the River Mersey boat, years ahead of the Beatles doing it.
And that's just to me, that's so precious, that information. Because, you know, I have friends that are, you know, have been radio stations and have been, you know, rock historians and following, you know, where the birth of Christian rock music came from and that type of thing. And when I talk to them about, you know, what we're talking about today and what we've been talking about, I'm going to say 9 out of 10, Doug, have never heard of it. And I'm not quite sure why it didn't make it over here. But
no.
There have been a few people, but not very many. And I'm thinking, okay, this is an incredible thing that was going on to me. Because I think what happens also, and we can talk about this, tell me what you think of this. When people... when there are, you know, there's secular music and then there's Christian music. And when people say, okay, I'm going to listen to secular music, and then some people think, well, that's fine, you do that, you know, just don't put it first and all that kind of, and I agree with that. But then there's also the music, there could be Christian music that is not that complex. It doesn't have the energy to it. It doesn't have the... kind of breaking the boundaries of music and the chord changes and all the things that people love in music. So when people started to hear Christian music that was equal with the secular music, what do you think happened then? Because that's got to be, to me, that's the coolest thing about this whole thing.
Indeed. Carry on.
Well, I was just thinking about that because you've got all this going on and then you've got people thinking, we've got some people over here that are pretty good. Take a, you know, listen to them.
So something that intrigues me is that the transition between sort of skiffle into more of a beat style was over a number of years, and as new students came into the college with different musical giftings. If you take the Brian Gilbert group, went into the recording studios of Evangelical Recordings, and they laid down 13 tracks that came out on two extended play records and two singles. Now, in 1959, I went to Spurgeon's College, and because Brian was a member of my home church, as soon as I went into college, the very first week I was in college, I was in the recording studio with Brian, laying down these 13 tracks. And when you look at the titles of those tracks, they were sort of transition stuff using traditional spirituals, Christian cowboy stuff. Christian Cowboy, written by Cindy Walker, was a favorite. Brian, because of his Spanish guitar skills, had a fantastic rendering in, you know, fantastic E minor chord and a finger ripple up the old belly of the guitar, and off he went with "The Devil Is a Rustler and Many Are His Men," and it sort of wowed people and absolutely fantastic. But it was Christian Cowboy stuff. We laid down one song that a couple of the Venturers had written. One that Brian had written. That was on the two EPs, and on the two singles, they were absolute standards. Again, two by Christian Cowboys. Stuart Hamblin, you remember him?
No.
"It Is No Secret," he wrote. Fantastic testimony of his change in the whole appearance of faith coming alive through a Billy Graham crusade in Los Angeles. The other one on the single was "Lord, Keep Your Mighty Hand on Me" by Red Harper. There's another Christian Cowboy, American style. So that's what the tone was on those first records. Old standards, slightly new in the way that traditional spirituals were being played. The Christian Cowboy stuff. And that's how the Venturers really got underway, using the old standards and some of the newer sort of music was being created in the 50s. Stuart Hamblin wrote, I think, in 1952, "It Is No Secret," and Red Harper in 1952 again, "Lord, Keep Your Mighty Hand on Me." So it was an experience coming over from the States, particularly to do with Brian's style, that he was able to pick up, and that's how it started. But the transition was on. And we began to see change as newer members came into the group.
Now, what I'd like to do now, Doug, is take a music break. And for our listeners out there, my guest is Doug Hollidge. And Doug was a member of the Venturers and the Brian Gilbert group. And you can go on the 1960sChristianMusic.com website. And John Plater has done a great job to go out and listen to all this different music that's out there. And this interview with Doug will be in podcast right after it's over, and I just think it's great that we can capture this time, and I really appreciate, Doug, you being on the show to share your experiences. Now, let's play, I think you mentioned this song, let's play "Lord, Keep Your Mighty Hand on Me," and that's a Venturer song, and that was, now, when was this recorded, and what year?
This was recorded in 1959.
Okay. And could you kind of introduce the song and maybe introduce the people that were in the recording?
The people in the recording is Brian Gilbert, who was sort of the lead guitarist. We had Ken Mullis on violin. I came in, my instrument bringing into the group is my voice. I subsequently began to learn the guitar and learn the clarinet. But the principal instrument that I brought to the group was my voice. So it was made up of young students, possibly gifted in music, putting together standards, and that's how it went.
And we'll play this. This is the Venturers. This is "Lord, Keep Your Mighty Hand on Me." And we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Doug after this.
You laid your hand, mighty Lord, on the range, laid your wand. apple farmed on the prairie. Lord, you poured forth the fountains, raised up the mountains. Oh Lord, keep your mighty hand on me. You touched your clouds, made them rain. From the rain made the sea. From the sea formed the clouds to give us life abundantly. You have the earth and the sky in your command, Lord. Oh, please keep your mighty hand on me. Your clouds made them rain. From the rain made the sea. From the sea formed the clouds to give us life abundantly. You have the earth and the sky in your command, Lord. Oh, please keep your mighty hand on me.
And we're back on John Talk Radio with my guest, Doug Hollidge of The Venturers and the Brian Gilbert Group. And we just heard, Lord, Keep Your Mighty Hand on Me. Now, was that at the time of Gene Autry and that type of music?
Yep. You're dead right, man.
Yeah, and I mean, there's I love hearing that. To me, it's got a great, I mean, everything just sounds good on it. I mean, the production. How was that done? I mean, was the recording done at the college?
No. The recording of that was done at the Evangelical Recording Studio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, how was that experience for you?
Well, it wasn't a new experience for me. It was for a number of the group. I'd done a couple of 78s before that as a young soprano. I think about it and I'm keeling over with laughter, but there we are. They were very much family things, and I'd been in studios. I'd gone up to HMV in Regent Street, and it was all professionally done, so it didn't scare me too much going into a recording studio. So it went okay.
Well, that's good. Now, from that point, let's talk about, now you join the band, and where does it go from there? And how much time, I mean, was it more of a full-time thing at that point, you know, being in the band? How did that take your time? And I also know there were a lot of other things going on. So what happened from that point on after the recording and where you went from there, your part of the band, and how the band progressed at that point?
Yeah, well, what the feature of life at Spurgeon's was that during vacation times, there was time sort of that you were expected to go out on the road and do evangelism in some way, which meant that those of us in the music group would always be going into a setting where the music group could be used. And week in and week out during term time at the weekends, again, as became more and more well known throughout the London area, home counties, and further afield, we'd be out on journeys late Friday night through Saturday, over Sunday, and coming back dead dog tired and shattered to the college in the Monday morning. And you then sort of go through your college curriculum, waiting till the next weekend when maybe you'd be out again Saturday, Sunday. And it was hugely involved, and folks began to see that this approach would draw youngsters in, not so much youngsters, but those alienated from the sort of typical church outreach programs, outreach to those already in, rather than outreach to those who are actually out. And so it became a real style. And as the group sort of gathered around itself a whole number of individuals, over a period of years in Spurgeon's, there were some 30 men who became part of the group, which meant that in a weekend, two or three could go out with a guitar, a soloist, whatever, and they'd sing and play. And at the major vacations, a much larger group would be involved in outreach. So it was a time of real development, and the intrinsically different style that was beginning to be born was when another one of those strange moments in time when things change happened in a South London church, when Brian went to play and sing, and a young guy who was already in a band in the locality in which he lived listened to Brian, and it really intrigued him, challenged him, and he knew that his call to ministry would be going to Spurgeon's and coming into the Venturers. Now, this was Mike Wood, and he brought to the music of the group a totally different approach, because he had written stuff that was much more in a bluesy, soft rock sort of style. And he, in fact, came up with the one song that was called the most blasphemous that the group ever used, in that it dared to use John 3:16, the full words of John 3:16, for God so loved the world, that's that fantastic verse, but set to a rock sort of style. And my goodness, what the very conservative Christian press made of that, you don't want to know.
Well, that's what I love about it. That's the thing, Doug, that I think is so awesome. Because it's like being able to, okay, I know this is what we're supposed to do, but give it a listen. And let's go back to when you heard Mike's, when he started writing it. Do you remember thinking, okay, this is something different. This is something pretty cool. Do you remember that time?
Oh, I do, because it started off in a finger-clicking sort of way. And that was dangerous stuff.
Yep.
To start into a bluesy number in that way. And I knew right from the start that this was going to be a fantastic song, and it became one of the great songs that the Venturers sang in all sorts of different places. There were three songs that were absolute favorites. One standard, which was How Great Thou Art, which was sung everywhere on every occasion out of request. But the other two were Can It Be True and John 3:16. And there's a wonderful add-on to the John 3:16 is that the current principal of Spurgeon's College, the guy in charge down there in South Norwood, was in a band with his then fiance, but now his wife, and they played, not knowing who the Venturers were, they played John 3:16 as one of their set.
Oh,
and
wow.
He describes it as the most precious thing, because it stood out completely from the old style traditional stuff and was really challenging. And when he knew finally that it was the Venturers, he was truly amazed. And that's the guy who's currently the principal of Spurgeon's College today.
Oh, that's amazing. Why don't we take the time right now, Doug, to play that song?
Let's play
John 3:16. And I think it'll be very important for the listeners to hear this in context to the story you just told. So this is the Venturers. This is John 3:16. And you're listening to John Talk Radio with my special guest, Doug Hollidge. And we'll be right back after this.
Jesus is the Savior who I love to know. Heaven is the haven where I'm going to go. Jesus is the captain who now leads my life. Unworthy as I am, I know He came to save. A sinner such as me, a sinner such as me, He came to save from the grave. For God so loved
gardens on, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Sometimes when you're feeling all alone and blue, Jesus can come in and help to pull you through. Sometimes you just know that you need Jesus too. So come on, sinner, come to him, he died for you. A sinner such as you, a sinner such as me, he came to save from the grave. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Captain, could I lead my life? Unworthy as I am, I know he came to save. A sinner such as me, a sinner such as me, he came to save from the grave.
That's The Venturers, John 3:16, recorded in 1959. And it's still... I just love hearing that, because to me it's a great privilege to be able to hear these songs and to be able to know how this was captured and how it was recorded, and to just hear this part of Christian music history. And we have Doug Hollidge on the show with us, who was there, and I think it's just so amazing to have that firsthand account of what was going on. Well, we started the show off, Doug, with Can It Be True? Now, I know you and I talked a little bit about that off air, but let's talk about that song. I don't believe we've done that yet. And talk about that and how that song has grown, and the different artists that have used it. And that's a perfect example to me of a seed that is sown, and how that, you know, you never know what's going to happen to that seed, but you start seeing how it grows and how it's used in different ways. And I believe you were even saying Cliff Richard even as used.
That's right. That's right. Can I, just a slight correction. John 3:16 was recorded in 1962.
Oh, okay.
This is when Mike Wood had come into college,
okay.
And the transition had taken place from the old style much more to this newer style. So that was in 1962. But speaking about Can It Be True, this became the song because it had four chords repeated endlessly throughout the whole song that everybody but anybody who could play a guitar began to play and use throughout the country. And it became the sort of number one favorite. Going to churches or on outreach occasions, they would say, sing Can It Be True. Now, the story behind this is intriguing. Regularly from college, of a Monday lunchtime, we would pile ourselves into a beat-up old dormobile and drive the few miles from South Norwood up to Tower Hill, where the Tower of London is, the famous Tower of London. And in that concourse, there was an area where free speech could take place every lunchtime. And we were up there on a Monday lunchtime regularly. We'd sing and play and then maybe preach for 5 minutes out of the headlines of the newspapers. And then we'd be up for questioning by all sorts of business guys and gals who were having their lunch in that sort of area.
Wow.
After one of these occasions, a guy came up to us, very recognizable, because he was in the brown habit and sandals of a Franciscan friar.
Wow.
And he came up, had underneath his arm an attaché case, and he said, "Lads, I've been listening to you singing. I appreciate what you're doing. I've written a few songs. Would you like to see them?" And he gave me, I've got the actual copy of the music that he gave me, and included in the Songs of a Sinner, words and music by Brother William, Society of St. Francis, was this song, Can It Be True? Now, we were looking at it for the very first time. We'd taken it back to college, and we'd looking at it for the very first time and thought, well, we can't use this because it's all to do with the recognition of Jesus in the Eucharistic rite. It was a five-verse song, and it was totally aimed at understanding what the Eucharist was all about. But somehow, some of the verses, two of the verses absolutely complete, we thought we could use those, and we thought that half of another verse and half of another verse could be cobbled together, and it would change the whole emphasis from recognizing Jesus in the Eucharist as being challenged by the Jesus who came into history. And we got in touch with him and said, look, we're in the Baptist tradition. We can't really sing something that identifies Jesus in the actual bread and wine, not the real sort of transubstantiation thing that the song originally was about, but we would love to use our own arrangement of it. And he agreed. Songs of a Sinner wasn't a sort of well-known book. It was very locally produced by the Society of St. Francis down in Cerne Abbas in Dorset. And he agreed that we could use our particular version. Now, it's strange that when you had, I think, when were the Pebbles on? They were in February, weren't they?
Right.
You actually played their version of Can It Be True. But the Can It Be True that they sang was our version of Can It Be True. And you mentioned Cliff Richard. Cliff has brought it out on five different formats.
Wow.
Over the years. A couple of Christmas albums included Can It Be True, and an album that he did with reading the Bible, interspersing it with Christian songs, some of which he'd written himself. He included Can It Be True in that album. But it was our version. So we have this strange understanding that whenever you see it written on a record sleeve, the words and music are down there as by Brother William, but it was not the song that Brother William wrote. It's the Venturers' actual arrangement of it. And it came out in 1966. There was a songbook brought out called Youth Praise One. And in it was a number of innovative new songs, and four of our songs, including Can It Be True, was included in it. And what you read in the music copy is the title, Can It Be True, words and music, Brother William, arranged the Venturers, and then at the end of the music, this arrangement only, copyright by the Venturers, by kind permission. But that's it. It strangely became the most beautifully loved song. And if I mentioned the current principal of Spurgeon's, I can mention a president of a seminary in Lombard, Chicago, the Northern Seminary in Lombard in Chicago. Dr. Alistair Brown is there, and he and I met up some time ago in a very wide-ranging Baptist event in the summer. And it came out that Can It Be True was sung on this occasion by a music group that was sort of sending me up a bit, really. It was a late night thing, and this music group was sending up this old boy who's sort of sang Can It Be True way back in his early days. And Alistair Brown was there, and he said, Doug, I didn't know you were involved with that. And he tells the story of, as a young student before he became the minister, up in Scotland, singing Can It Be True, and really using it to convey gospel content, the challenge of the words, as people listen to the story of Jesus in a very understandable and accessible fashion. So it's a fantastic story of a song that came to us unexpectedly, that we thought bits of it we can use, and having chopped and changed it around, it became the absolute number one bestseller. Fantastic.
Now, how did you approach that when you got Brother William, the way that he wrote it originally? How did you guys look at that and say, okay, who took the parts in that, Doug, to say, okay, we can do this, we can change the lyrics? Was there also changes in the musical style, or was it just in the lyrics of the song?
No, it was just, I've got the copy right in front of me now, John, and in the book that Brother William gave to us, I see crossed out, the first verse is crossed out completely. The second verse, the half of it is crossed out. The second half of it is left in. And so it was simply the words that we were changing. The music was exactly the same. These four chords, stuck G, E minor, C, D7, G, E minor, C, D7. And it was so simple, but so beautifully put together. And with the three-verse version, simply spoke about a relationship with Jesus, the living Jesus, rather than through the Eucharistic rite.
Now, was there ever any communication with Brother William after the song came out by the Venturers?
No, I don't think so. He'd given us kind of carte blanche permission to use the songs, and he knew of the change in the lyric. And I think it was probably when the publishers of the music book got in touch with him that he expected that this version, because it, at that time, it hadn't been put out by Cliff or anything like that, so it was not internationally known. But Brother William simply said, okay, you can do your version, but make sure it's my word sort of business.
Yeah. Well, that's really amazing how that song has grown like that, and how that it's taken, you know, the different ways. Have you heard any other versions outside of Brother William and your and the Venturers version? I know that we've talked a little bit about Keith Richard, or not Keith, but Cliff Richard's version.
Yep.
Have there been other recordings that you would like to the listeners to know about?
No. That's the only one that there was one more song has been a cover version of one of Mike's songs called How Long has been done by another music group. But the one that really hits the headlines is Can It Be True, because it's been done by a number of folks. The Can It Be True is the main one, I think.
Now, let's go. We got about 12, 13 minutes left. Let's talk about you and your music, how that you got involved in music. And take us through, Doug, you know, as a young person and what music meant to you and some of the first things you did. You said you sang and you went into the recording studios. That's a pretty amazing path, because a lot of people don't do that or have the talents to do that. And I always think it's good, you know, to hear how that happens. Now, how was music nurtured with you, and how you got to become a part of your life and your ministry?
Well, it's fantastic. You had on in March Justin Reese of the Peacemakers.
Right.
Now, Tom Reese, Justin's father, he mentioned him, but Tom Reese was very much a part of the inspiration for me developing a sort of very natural gifting that I have had of a voice. I'm told by my family that I inherited my voice from my grandfather, who I never knew. He was dead and gone before I was born. But he had a voice. He could sing a song in a moment and make people cry. The very next song he would sing and he'd make them laugh. And folks said, well, you've got your grandfather's voice. I never had it trained. It was simply a natural gifting. And I was in choirs at school, singing solos, all sorts of things. But Tom Reese had huge meetings in the Royal Albert Hall, a huge venue, music venue in London, with
right,
classic
correct.
History of fantastic music. Tom Reese would hire the Royal Albert Hall and fill it with young people, not simply young people, though, but those on the edge of wanting something special. And music was very much a part of what he offered. And fantastic soloist that I really sort of took on board, and he became a real hero of mine, was a guy who's still alive, Frank Boggs. It's a name that you might know in the States. He's still alive. He's doing all sorts of things with choirs out there. But Frank Boggs had a very sort of bass baritone voice, and he was my inspiration. And beyond Frank Boggs, in my early and middle teens, George Beverly Shea was another
right.
soloist that became a huge influence to me. And the Billy Graham campaigns, in particular, in 1954, the final Billy Graham campaign at the huge Wembley Stadium, it was there that my call to full-time ministry actually came on board. I was a middle teenager, 16 years of age, and I knew at that meeting, because of various things that had happened, that I had to go into full-time ministry. And as soon as Brian was aware of this, he said, well, as soon as you come into college, you're coming straight into the group because, you know, we want your voice as part of what we're doing. So it was a very natural progression from well-nurtured youngster with a tremulously treble voice that developed into a lazy baritone, sometimes hitting lower tenor notes, and then now I'm much more a lazy baritone singing my way through all sorts of songs.
Well, talk about how what music has meant to you, Doug, and what importance you think it is in today's church. Because with me, I've spent a lot of time, you know, talking to musicians that I think are reaching people that could not be, and I really believe this, could not be reached without the music, because people just won't come in and listen to the sermons. They'll turn people off, but when they hear the music, it can be heavy metal music, rock music, country music, bluegrass music, every type of music that there is. When they hear that music, they're drawn in, and then they hear the lyrics, and then I believe the Holy Spirit can start working, because then it's like, okay, you're hearing, like John 3:16, the song that we played.
Mm-hmm.
You can, like you talked about, Doug, people can say this and that about the music style. There can't be any confusion or anything around the lyrics, because they're directly from the scripture. You know,
that's right.
Yeah. So, what's your take on Christian music today, and how important it is as a ministry and as a way to reach kids that maybe, or it's not always kids, but I think it has a lot to do with young people because they identify so much with music.
Yeah, I do have something to contribute here. Because my contribution to the group was mainly voice, I taught myself a bit of guitar, and there's a famous picture of me actually with a, what was it called? It was a Hofner President Thin Line, maple flamed, fantastic guitar.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
If I went out on my own, having learnt three chords and the use of a capo, I would be using this fantastic guitar that the actual group had bought through the proceeds of the second couple of EPs that we put out.
Oh, wow.
Having recorded them ourselves rather than going through a professional recording company. And those two later EPs actually provided money for all sorts of gospel outreach used by other men in Spurgeon's College. But as I say, my main contribution is simply voice. So having left college, I was very much dependent upon a pianist or somebody else to play and accompany in order to sing. So I've done a few songs I've written myself, but they don't get into any sort of publication these days because the modern sort of outlay for new published songs. These companies say you've got to be a known person. It's only safe if you're a known person. And they don't go far enough back to say that you are known and think that when you're in your late 70s, you know, you're unknown. I have to say that Brian is in his early 80s, still going strong.
Oh,
Brian's
awesome.
In his early 80s. But music is a very real part. I still sing a lot, and it's been great to be able to offer it to God in that special way, because you see the difference in people's lives as you're conveying something in music rather than in simply the preached word.
Now, during our conversation, is there anything, Doug, that you would like to, in the last couple minutes here, just tell the audience, or maybe something we missed that you think is important that the audience and the people know about this particular time and the Venturers and the Brian Gilbert group and the music of that time? Is there something we've missed that you maybe would like to just talk about?
Yeah, well, the style was of getting into venues or places that were different, that allowed you to proclaim through the music and the challenge of the spoken word. So the sort of venues that the Venturers went into were all sorts of new, the list is endless. I mentioned the Tower Hill open-air experience. We were playing on town bandstands, on pleasure boats. We played on a naval frigate. Not in wartime, but this sailor had heard us on one of our beach campaigns and said, my Navy boat is moored up in Portland Harbor. If I got you permission to come on board, can you play? And fantastic occasion like that. Beaches, churches large and small, marquees, hospitals, prisons, Borstal institutions, schools, colleges, coffee bars, pubs, clubs, dance halls, cinemas. We played in the largest cinema in London, 1,500 seats, on a Saturday morning when the kids who came were rough kids from the area, and we spent our time playing, avoiding the things that were being thrown at us. Quite interesting, but there we go. But all sorts of venues, and the point I'm making is that in those venues, strangely, people began to hear. And one of the fantastic stories I have, which is a personal story, is of going to my home, before I was married, taking my washing home as a bachelor down to my mum, get my mum to do the washing, whatever. I was in ministry a year before I married, and I'm sitting on a train, and opposite me a young man is looking at me in rather a disarming sort of way, and I'm wondering what's all this about. We both got off at a particular station, me to wait for another train to take me further towards my home, and he had obviously reached his destination. Before he turned away from me, he said, "You were in the Venturers. You came to the Portland Borstal, which is a sort of young offenders unit. You came to the Portland Borstal. My life hasn't been the same since."
Wow.
And he walked away. So when you introduced the Venturers, I almost wanted to come in and chip in and say, we're really called the Dinosaurs. We go back that far. But the footprints of the dinosaur are seen in all sorts of strange places. And it's a beautiful story that no end of the Venturers can tell, meeting up with people in these later years saying, "Oh, I've still got a copy of your record." And that's one of the most disarming things to have put before you, sort of a Sunday lunchtime, you're the visiting preacher, and instead of a plate, someone puts the record in front of you and say, "See, I've still got the record."
That's
and children still say, "We've got the record." But the opportunity to pronounce Christ in different situations. You've got a guy currently in the States called David Kinnaman, part of the Barna Group, done all sorts of surveys on young people and young adults. He says the church for too long has been boring and predictable. It's as though you've got a powerful amplifier, unfortunately suffering poor connectivity through faulty wiring to ineffectual speakers. And I think as a sort of musical picture, it's fabulous to say that the church is ill-prepared to hear what Jesus really wants us to hear. And he goes on to say that the third place option to get involved in the tough places of the world is not natural or easy, but we have still the message to proclaim that is to do with purity, but also to do with proximity. Music allows us to get the proximity right, to get into venues that you would never ever get into if you were simply pushing out the purity thing from a pulpit. The pulpit that is unquestionably still 6 feet above contradiction. And it's as though this modern world, the caricature of the church is that you go through a graveyard into a building that looks like a mausoleum to join the aged and the dying, listening to music that is distinctly funereal, to be assured that money that we put in the plate will keep the roof on for another couple of years. That's the sad picture of a lot of the church. The challenge, musically, is to step into that and get a proximity that is challenging.
Well, Doug, it's been totally amazing talking to you, and I appreciate it. I just want to say thank you so much, and it would be great to have you back on sometime.
Hey, thank you very much.
My guest is Doug Hollidge, and Doug was a member of the Brian Gilbert Group and the Venturers, and this podcast will be available in about 5 minutes. And we're going to continue to explore the Christian beat music and the Christian music of England and the UK, and we're eventually going to get into the U.S. But, Doug, it's been great. Thank you so much, and we'll keep in touch.
Well, bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to John Talk Radio tonight. And everybody have a great evening.
Come to the end of life's journey, weary and worn, and the battle is done. Carrying the cross of redemption, he'll understand and say, understand and say, well done. Give when you give the best of your service, telling the world that the Savior has come. Be not dismayed if man won't defend you, he'll understand and say, well done. He'll understand and say, well done. Oh, when you try and fail in the work you have begun.